Blog Talk Radio.
Well, folks, welcome to Politics Done Right. I am Egberto Willis, your dutiful host. Thank you for spending some of your valuable weekend time. I know this is the height of the hour on a weekend. We're doing the things we need to do, the things that we need to do that we can't get done because we are hard workers. After all, 99% of the reason the country that it is. Yet, it never seems that we, the people, get the break. We, the people, never do. Last week, for the very first time in years, Politics Done Right went black. No sound. We were off the air because I had a brunch that I had to attend, and it was not possible, or I couldn't find someone to take over the show. Now, Coffee Party family, we need producers, okay? We need somebody or a couple of people that are going to be here to produce this show as well. Remember, this is a group effort that we want. It's not only about this show, it's about the other shows, but particularly for my show, Delan, one of our directors, will be talking to some of you to become producers of this show to actually decide the kinds of things that you want on this show, not only what I want, what you want, and also that in the event that I have to go and do something else, you can take the show over and work for that week. And who knows, when you're ready, you actually do your own show as well. Remember, we are trying to build spheres of influence. I have mine, you have yours, Janine has hers, Eric has his. We all bring that together for one cause. So folks, if you're interested, drop me a line, drop Delan a line, and let us talk. 908, I see that you have your hands up. I wanted to read some of my blogs, but let me bring you in to see if there's something prescient you want to say in the beginning before I do my blogging, my verbal blogging. 908, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Hey, Egberto, it's John from Jersey. How you been?
Hey, John from Jersey. Thank
good.
You.
Good, I thought you were on vacation. That's what I thought.
No, not vacation, man. You know, we never rest here at Coffee Party, man. We're always doing something. We're always into something because, you know, the mission continues. The mission continues. You know what I mean?
Yep.
But anyway, let me get busy getting through with my monologue, and then we'll go ahead and talk. I think more people should be in by then. For those not ready yet, please do remember the number is 646-929-2495 to call in. 646-929-2495. You have something to say. And look, I don't care where you are in the spectrum of things, what you believe or whatever. I want to hear your point of view because that's what we're all about in Politics Done Right. We're all in one country. We all want to hear everybody's point of view. That's what the Coffee Party is all about. We don't want you to have to change what you believe necessarily. We want you to be able to express your belief and back your beliefs. And who knows, maybe you'll change. Who knows, maybe I'll change. We'll come somewhere that makes sense for us all. But anyway, this has been a very eventful week, very eventful 10 days. There are three issues that I said I would talk about unless you guys go ahead and do what you always do, and that is veer me away from what I said we were going to talk about. But again, this is your show. But the first blog I want to read is a blog that I did earlier this week. And it had to do with the 28-year-old student who found the mistake into prominent economists' paper, of which most conservatives, not only in the United States, but around the world, have been quoting and effecting policies on. They have been making policies. Governments have been making policies on a fraud. These people have caused riots. These people have caused deaths. And it sounds harsh. But when you are effecting policy that affects people's lives and causing deaths, you are to be blamed. But anyway, here goes the blog. And the blog was titled, 28-year-old grad student destroys economists, destroying European and American economies. And it goes as follows. The entire world must get mad. Every middle class and poor American must get mad. Politicians around the world have effected policies based on a fraud. The policies effected based on this fraud has cost millions their jobs, their wealth, and some even their lives. Yet, if one follows the way this story is covered, I mean covered within the media, it's a blip on the radar. What gives? The story starts with two supposedly renowned economists, specifically Carmen Reinhart and Kenneth Rogoff, releasing of the paper titled Growth in the Time of Debt. This paper was in line with American and the world's right-wing conservative ideology that focused almost exclusively on debt reduction. The basic conclusion of the paper was that debt above 90% of GDP would cause negative growth. The paper was one of the most cited papers in finance and economic journals and the media. Paul Ryan cited it in his Path to Prosperity, Middle Class Killing Budget. It was used to effect destabilizing austerity policies in Europe and now in the United States. What is upsetting is that the New York Times gave a non-peer-reviewed piece of work, a very long article in their paper titled, They Did Their Homework, 800 Years of It. They did this article in 2010. The title implies a completeness and gravitas on that paper that simply was not there. The New York Times should have known that Rogoff was nothing but a right-wing hack. There was ample evidence under his tenure at the IMF, partially during the Argentinian financial debacle, exacerbated by IMF austerity policies, their growth projections failed. They failed just as pitifully for Venezuela. Argentina underperformed using austerity policies. Venezuela overperformed using Keynesian policies. Further, the open letter he sent to Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, after Stiglitz justifiably criticized the evil actions of the IMF, made it clear Rogoff was a right-wing ideologue and not a real economist. For a very long time, Mr. Rogoff and Ms. Reinhart declined to provide the data to have their work peer-reviewed. It took 28-year-old University of Massachusetts Amherst grad student Thomas Herndon to debunk their nonsense in his paper titled, Does High Public Debt Consistently Stifle Economic Growth? A Critique of Reinhart and Rogoff. He co-authored this paper with Michael Ash and Robert Polin. Herndon found three blatant and obvious problems with the Rogoff-Reinhart paper that seasoned peer-reviewed economists would never have had. They arbitrarily selected subsets of periods to validate the outcome. They weighted different data relative to each other subjectively. And they had a rookie Excel coding error that mysteriously excluded Australia, Austria, Belgium, Canada, and Denmark from their calculations, which cumulatively voided their outcome. And then within the blog, I gave a link directly to their paper. I mean, remember, here at Politics Done Right, we are just fact-based. We're not here trying to make anybody happy. Fact-based, trying to tell our folks, get out there and do the job. I continue. Reinhart and Rogoff made an attempt to rebut Mr. Herndon with two rebuttals, and I give links to the two rebuttals that they gave in the blog post as well, and you can find that inside of the blog post for this show, where in effect, they acknowledged the error. They claim that even with the error, their conclusion is correct, but took exception with the apparent view that their error was ill-intended. Herndon, the guy who found the error, responded with the definitive response proving that the renowned economists were simply wrong while not attributing it to willful error. But I tell you what, folks, this author, myself, I will, after reviewing Rogoff's history, is I am willing to state that more likely than not, this was a willful error to promote an ideology that is weak, that is wreaking havoc worldwide. The paper came at just the right time, a time when everyone knew more Keynesian stimuli was required around the world. Again, I'm stating, the person who found the error decided to be nice. He didn't want to accuse these guys of saying this paper was ill-intended. This paper came out. They made these errors on purpose. These are renowned economists. These errors, while I have no definitive proof, all the empirical data would tell you this was done on purpose for an ideology. Study who Rogoff is. Study the error in the Excel spreadsheet that even a neophyte would not make, but that made the numbers skew to one direction. Study the subsets that they used. Study the weighting that they gave different countries. Study the interval in times that they used to compute their data. The circumstantial evidence in a court would be enough to convict these hacks of what they've actually done. And I'm sorry to be that blunt, but these guys have allowed their paper to be used to raise havoc, not only on the United States economy, but on the world's economy. Continuing. When renowned Wall Street analysts, and I call him a pariah because I don't know who knows this guy. It's another story. But anyway, when renowned Wall Street analyst, the pariah, writes an article titled, "The Economic Argument is Over. Paul Krugman Has Won." It means that, in fact, the abject nonsense the right-wing conservatives have been promoting, which have destroyed many an economy, has been completely debunked. Nixon, talking about President Nixon, realized this back in 1970, in the 70s. It took a regression back into willful ignorance, beginning with Reagan's policies to destroy many an economy and the middle class. This is a very big story, folks. It must get traction. It must have traction. Lives are being destroyed by policies based on Reinhart and Rogoff's work. One can only hope it is not too late to undo the economic evil of the last 30 years, 30 plus years, and the malicious justification by two economic hacks. This is serious, folks. And what's most upsetting is that in as much as all these things that we're seeing occurring in Greece and elsewhere with austerity trying to be thrown onto economies all over, it is sad that our media is not making this a huge story, because it is. This is a big story. Every single person listening to my voice at this point in time should be throwing on their Facebook to their entire sphere of influence, should be throwing on Twitter, should be throwing on Tumblr, should be throwing everywhere, should be talking to their relatives, their families, their friends about how two economies could destroy or could lay the seeds for the destruction of the world's economy to benefit a few. That's how serious this is. And no one is covering it appropriately. Yes, it's all over the internet. Yes, it's at a lot of left-wing blogs. Why isn't it at right-wing blogs? Why isn't it it everywhere plastered? Everyone should be covering this story. This has a material effect on your life. This has a material effect on your life. It must be covered. Folks, the telephone number, and before I move on to the other blog, I wish more people would call and discuss this issue. If you followed what I was saying, if you're a bit dubious about it and need some explanations, we can go over that. The number is 646-929-2495. Again, that number is 646-929-2495. If you want to talk, please push 1. And I really want you guys to push 1, because before I get to the other subjects, which are important as well, this subject here is important, folks, because governments across the world are making policies on this. And whether it's the full implementation here in the United States or not, it's been implemented in England. It's killing their economy. It's been implemented in Greece. It's killing their economy. And their economy is not separate from ours. England, the UK, Greece, they're all trading partners, and their economies suffer. It brings down our GDP. And this is because we have right-wing hacks that are promoting policies that materially affect economies. Folks, this is real. We have to make this real to people around the world. It has to be made real. I know it to some extent we're in the weeds. We're talking about Keynesian economics, and we're talking about whether a spreadsheet is right. And to a lot of people, this may sound, this is kind of, I don't know if I want to get deep into that. Well, you better, because it materially affects your life. You're a student, it affects your life. You're a teacher, it affects your life. An engineer, it affects your life. John, I see you just cycled. Talk to me.
Yeah. First, I want to say, before I get into my comment on that, tonight is the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which is always hilarious and funny. So, just for everybody out there, I saw just recently, just a few minutes ago, they had a review of the FAA, debacle, and they went into how great Reagan was with it, and of course, Obama's a disaster, and his ways with the sequester, and look what Reagan was able to do. And regardless, I saw a thing. It was interesting, as we talk about Reagan. Actually, Reagan was the greatest spender, percentage wise, of any president.
We know,
of the
yeah,
day.
Exactly, my friend.
He was.
You're
he was
correct.
The greatest percentage. He decided to go from a 450 ship navy to an over 600 and something navy. He was the biggest spender of them all. But anyhow, there was an interesting thing on Chris Hayes' show, which sort of relates into this and all that, which I found was very interesting. And it has to do with They had the thing about long-term unemployment, and only 4 Congress members showed up, and they were all Democrats. Okay.
Right.
And the Chris Hayes' show on Wednesday went into a thing where that actually maybe they desire this long-term unemployment, and the reasons why. They didn't say with saying companies like Walmart, but they basically were hinting at Walmart and other big companies, okay, loving this kind of thing because of the fact that, we're talking austerity here, okay, loving the fact so that if their employees got sort of rowdy in the sense of wanting to unionize, okay, that they could basically put it down the measures because they could always find long-term unemployed
cheap
out
labor.
There.
Yeah.
Yeah, cheap labor out there. So another thing about the austerity, as far as the employment factor or whatever, that they're trying to, and I believe, you know, this Chris Hayes report sounds, you know, very intelligent, that they're not concerned with long-term unemployment. They're concerned with the FAA and they're, you know, McCain and all these other people getting a flight, you know, and not concerned with the long-term unemployed because of the unions. They still want to break down the unions, and they could care less about how many people are actually, the certain percent are unemployed. And to them, it's fine because it's good for big business.
Look, you hit it on the money. I mean, the truth of the matter is nobody is really putting effort into areas where effort needs to be placed. And that is why we talk about having to get people activated, because when those people started to feel the delays on the FAA, and there's a blog I was going to read about that when we got into the section talking about what the politicians just did with that. So I want to kind of leave that part about the FAA offs. But when it comes to what you're saying about the Walmart wanting high unemployment, look, there is ample evidence out there, John, ample evidence, we know that austerity has been killing economies. There is zero evidence. Don't believe what the right wings tell you with some of the Heritage Foundation studies, et cetera. They're all cooked by using specific periods as opposed to the aggregate. You cannot believe any of the information coming from these hacks. I wrote a blog approximately middle of last week, and it had to do with the Powell memo. Have you ever heard about the Powell memo?
No.
Okay. All right. Powell was a corporate lawyer who was on the board of many corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did is he realized that the pure capitalist model that was being followed was being hit by the liberal side of the country because of the inherent, or what I like to call systemic flaws that have to be mitigated by policy. As an example, what I mean by that is, if you were to have a pure capitalist model, eventually all wealth and it's just a mathematical fact, because of the way money grows, all wealth naturally goes to the top. It's just the way mathematics work. Okay. And what liberals have been doing, progressives have been doing all along, is using our tax code to mitigate that. In other words, nobody is saying let's kill capitalism. They've been saying, let's make capitalism exactly what it needs to be. And what does it need to be? Just a tool. A tool for a particular goal where it needs to be used. No, nothing else. And wherever it affects humanity negatively, we the people, government, to solve that problem. Now, I have other friends, other people that I hang with that simply think capitalism is simply unworkable. I am not there. I think there are areas where raising of capital through that model works. However, there are areas it does not work. And there are areas where government must act. Krugman will tell you that. Stiglitz will tell you that. And there's another socialist, I don't remember his name at this point in time, that will also tell you that quite, I mean, he actually has the numbers to tell you that, and that would be Richard, what's his last name? Richard, whatever. I'll think of him a little bit later. So, all these things put together, all these different items put together, are known facts that are backed up by provable math, by provable models, and at the same time, we can look at real life experience. We can see that as soon as England instituted its austerity model, it placed itself into a three-dip recession. We can see that Greece's economy using austerity didn't grow or get better. It shrank. These are absolute numbers that can be seen factually. The university student who found the errors in the paper showed, using real-world data, what the truth was. So we are not just talking out the side of our mouths here. We have actual evidence to back up the things that we're saying. Now, earlier I told you about the Powell letter, and the reason why I want to bring that back up is because it's rather important, and anybody who gets a chance. I'm looking to see if I have that as one of the readings within on my blog post for the show. But I think I do, and I think it was in the case. Let's see, which one was it in? Oh, I can't find it right now, and I don't think it's a good thing to use this time to try to find it. But what Powell was saying is, look, we have to start creating institutions. Actually, I did find it. We have to start creating institutions so that we can, in effect, indoctrinate America, because the speakers on the left are vibrant. I mean, if you read his memo, it's just amazing. Because what he's telling folks is that he's telling them, look, these speakers on the left are so good that they are starting to convince people that our way is not the right way, that somehow what we are doing is wrong. And we cannot allow the great things that were done with free enterprise. And, you know, it was amazing to me how Powell, this guy who later became Supreme Court Justice Powell, it was amazing to me how he was able to conflate free enterprise with capitalism, which free enterprise and capitalism are not the same thing. You know, they're absolutely not the same thing. But he was able to conflate them together. So they created institutes like... what's the name of this particular institute? I don't know if you ever heard of the Heritage Foundation.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. They created institutes like the Heritage Foundation, and they created the Cato Institute, and all these different think tanks. And the purpose of these think tanks were not to – the purposes weren't to get the truth. It was to ensure – that they actually had ideological backing for the crap that they put out there. And it is important that, you know, I mean, if you take a look at these guys when they're on a TV station or whatever, you'll hear them say things like, well, you know, the Cato Institute said that, or the Heritage Foundation said XYZ. And the whole thing behind that is to give it an air of what I call plausibility. Make it seem like it has some sort of gravitas in it, like it has some real well-meaning issue behind it. That's what we're talking about. Before I forget, folks, the telephone number is 646-929-2495. Again, that number is 646-929-2495. I would love to hear from you guys. This is an important subject that I don't want to get off of right now, because I would love to hear what many of you are thinking about relative to the story, or if you even understand the story. And if you don't, ask so that we can really clarify the seriousness that we really need to look at this subject with. Because I tell you, when I saw it, when I saw the work from that young man, I really, really wanted to cry, because so much was done. So much literature was done based on this particular paper. What do you think, John?
Oh, what you said was excellent, the whole thing that you had said. But I wanted to touch up on another subject. We did have what occurred in Boston, and, you know, there were three and then fourth life that was lost. Of course, a lot of people were injured. And then, of course, we had this thing in Texas, you know, and actually more people lost their lives on that.
In Texas, in the bomb, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and I saw a thing on Facebook, which I'd like to reveal and say, which to me is quite an interesting kind of quote or whatever, you know, that if you, as, you know, back then, no regulation kind of stuff. And if you, you know, don't desire regulation, then at this point, you know, there's no need for us to help finance, you know, for the devastations as they're now requesting relief from. And but they you know, this whole notion from the Republican Party, the Tea Party, and the Libertarian part of the Republican Party, of the GOP, and you know, laissez-faire completely. Well, then that's what you wanted. And you know, but here in Sandy, the storm Sandy, you know, it's part of the sequester. You know, there's $1 billion that's being cut from Sandy for you know, in New Jersey. And
I didn't realize that Sandy got cut as well. I thought that was completely separate.
No, because of the sequester, as I was hearing on Bill Maher's show, or one of the or either Bill Maher's show or the actual thing that they were talking about, the sequester on with the FAA and sequester. I think it was that, actually. And they were saying that there was $1 billion because, you know, that got scaled back.
Wow. You
but
know,
meanwhile, Texas, I know you're from Texas, but meanwhile, Texas Republicans, you're not a Republican from Texas, but meanwhile, they want everything afforded to them in regards to what happened at this plant.
Oh, actually, you know, I mean, the president called Rick Perry rather quickly. I did a blog on that. In fact, I put it out today. I kind of had a hunch somebody would bring that up, because, you know, the governor, our governor, Rick Perry, the guy who was running for president, who went out and said, get government out of regulation, get government out of our lives, get government out of all of this, and we don't need to do all this spending.
Mm-hmm.
Guess who wants his monies right away for this emergency?
And yeah, your governor.
But here's the funny thing.
And you know what's very interesting? And I actually heard this too. And this was on the Bill Maher show, and then some other show that I'd saw. Do you know the cost of this the library for Bush down in Texas? Okay, they said it. $500 million, roughly, in 2 years that it cost to build this place. It was like maybe just over 2 years to build this library. Okay,
mm-hmm.
$500 million, and roughly half of that money, so 250 somewhere in that million, was private donations, for which those private donations, they won't reveal who actually donated, okay? You know, they won't. And, you know, of course, that makes people suspicious, you know, of things, of course, in regards to policies that were such back then. But additionally, $250 million is yours and my money, okay, was put into this library. Now, let's not forget, that's not including the upkeep. And maybe if they're going to create another annex to it.
Wait a second. Let's separate two things. Because, and you may have to, you may correct me if not, but I read that the building was built, the entire library was built with public funds, but because it was turned over to the archives, it will be run by federal dollars going forward.
No, what I heard was it was half the money was private, you know, so therefore, yeah, okay, there's private money, sure, but half the money was from the federal government. And then, of course, let's just take it over all the years.
Let me ask you to do one thing, John.
It'll be a lot of money.
Before you go further, because the one thing we want to always, when we have people leave this show, we want them to leave knowing that, you know, we're not Rush Limbaugh or one of these guys that fill them up with misinformation. So let's make sure, let's put in a record that we're not exactly sure if of that particular statement, just because I don't want.
That's what I had heard.
Right.
I don't see and understand probably why not, because, well, first of all, you know, let's say there was no monies, limited monies or whatever. They're still out to build the library, you know. And,
well, you know, let me tell you one thing, though, John, an important thing I want to say here. Mm-hmm. I understand why they're so willing to get all that money in, because remember, the right wing has to clean up Bush's legacy, because Bush's legacy was the right, you know, what people don't understand is this, okay? We actually saw our economy was completely collapsed. Our foreign policy was completely collapsed. All these bad things occurred. But how did these bad things occur? We actually had implemented in this country right-wing policies on steroids. In other words, we know what the outcome is when these policies are instituted. So we had 2 8-year administrations to look at two types of policies. And by the way, I am not going to give neither President Obama or President Clinton a pass on the things that I think they should have done differently. But by the same token, they were not right-wing administrations on steroids. What am I trying to say here? Bush got all that he wanted in implementation. When we look at completely reducing taxes, or getting rid of an additional ton of regulations, all these things occurred. This is the right-wing mantra, okay? And we see the results. Under Clinton, yes, he continued a lot of the supply-side policies. President Obama continued some of the supply-side policies, but mostly because, I don't want to say mostly he didn't have any choice. I want to say mostly because I think the mode of operation that he runs on is to assume that that populism cannot work in this country. And until we prove to him otherwise, I think we're going to get mediocre policy. What am I trying to say? I think while President Clinton was a true centrist and his policies were more positive than negative, when we look at President Obama, I think President Obama is left of center, governing right of center, because he thinks populism doesn't really work, or so far has not worked, and it is something that groups like ours, Coffee Party, let's say with a 535 type project, move to amend by doing real grassroots movement, education, etc., is going to be necessary to give these guys legs, to let these guys know not only that we have your back, because it's not about having your back, is about telling you we know what needs to actually get done in this country to move it forward. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know. So, folks, the number 646. So right now, there's just a dialogue going on with John from Jersey and me, while I still see many of you on the line. 646-929-2495. Hit 1 to talk. 646-929-2495. Hit 1 to talk if you want to ask some questions. But the subject at hand that we are still talking about, that I really would have liked to go for a whole hour, because I want people to know how important it is that policies by both Paul Ryan and his budget and what the House Republicans currently believe in are based on a fraudulent paper written by two economists. Two economists that, for all practical purposes, have put the world's economies, in turmoil. This is important, folks. This is extraordinarily important. We need people. We need people. I see somebody put a note up here. Let me see what that is about. Is that you, Janine? If that is you who placed that, I would love for you to call and talk about what you thought about this as well. I didn't get a chance to listen to your show this Thursday. Oh, Matt Taibbi's piece. Interesting. Did you read it all? If you read it all, I'd love to hear a little synopsis of it. Let me see. 707, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
This is Linda in Northern California.
Linda in Northern California. Talk to me, Linda.
Hi. I had to get off the phone. I think you didn't see me with my hand raised before, so there may be something wrong with your board.
Okay, maybe I just didn't catch it. I'm so sorry, but thank you for calling in and calling
back. Oh,
that's
okay. Well, I just thought you might want to know. Okay, I was just going to say I'm going through a bunch of papers that I brought back. I went to the convention in California.
Roots Rockers?
No, it was the Democratic Convention.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, and I was carrying a proxy, so I went and I sat through all the resolutions and everything. And, you know, they had like 80 of them, and they had to whittle them down until like 10. And Move to Amend had one, too, by the way.
Right,
but,
we know.
Yeah, the ladies were trying to get their language in there, and I think it got pushed off till July, because they have to talk to they rolled a bunch of things together, resolutions together to make one resolution, but they left out some of the language that I know you guys want. You know.
Yeah, you see, a lot of people want to just look at before I'm gonna let you finish, but I want to get something clear with the Move to Amend, because this is a very, very important. There are a lot of people that are just simply concentrating on what is it called? They are simply concentrating on Citizens United. Money is not
right.
Speech. But very importantly, we think that people also must look at corporate personhood. Because the reality is, and I don't know how to say this without going against our own, without sounding like I'm going against our own mission, but if you actually tell a corporation that you have the rights of people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then the rights of people come free speech. And then it becomes, how do you define free speech? So, I mean, I am not a lawyer, but From a layman's view, I can see why corporations operate the way they do and how they are able, because of being able to consider themselves persons, manipulate the Supreme Court to come up with the decisions that it's coming up with. But anyway, I just wanted to put that in there. Please continue, Linda.
Okay, well, I was just going through, I think I found the one that they had. But anyway, what basically happened is they need to the two ladies that were there for the language you're talking about.
Right.
They they argued the point, but I'm not sure it got through. Basically, so the because there was this big, you know, the committee there, and they had like 80 of them to go through. So I think they were kind of rushing.
Yeah, I mean, that is usually the case, but what happens a lot of times, and I think you fell off, Linda, for some reason you fell off the board, so you may want to call back in. But I think what happens a lot of times is that people don't understand why the real importance that we have with ensuring that we don't give corporations inalienable rights, that is reserved for flesh and blood human beings. And as such, all these created entities must be regulatable. I don't know if regulatable is a word or not. I'm sure somebody will correct me if it's not. That is important. Hey, Janine, I see you there, Janine. Let me go back to Linda, and then I'm going to come to you, Janine, because I really want to hear your opinion on what happened with those economists. Linda, this is you again, right?
Yeah, this is me. I don't know. There was a weird noise, and then it cut off.
Right.
Okay, well, basically, it's going to go until, what I was saying, it's going to go until July. They need to talk to the people, the authors of the other resolutions, and then maybe come up with language that everybody can agree with.
Right.
So it's not dead. It's just, you know. Because I had the move to amend button and the whole bit, you know, and I was walking
right
around passing out the literature. But back to austerity, the person you were trying to think of, I think, was Robert Reich.
No, actually, it was Richard. Robert Reich, I have a lot of respect for as well. In fact, we did an interview with him here at Coffee Party on one of my shows. I have it logged in there somewhere. Robert Reich is great. In fact, the book that he wrote, we had it in our book club. I don't know. I'm pretty sure Janine is going to remember the name of the book. Do you remember the name of that book, Janine?
Whose book?
Robert Reich?
Say it again. Oh, no, I don't. But I'll Google it while you guys are talking.
Yeah, excellent. But yeah, Linda, it's Richard Holmes or Richard. No, I'll find it. The name of that.
Yeah, I'd like
that
to speak.
Yeah, he's. It's important for folks to find out and know about these economists that have numbers behind them, because we get guys from the Cato Institute and the Heritage Foundation and all these guys that come out here. They have the semblance. They give you the semblance of being an unbiased source, but in reality, they are nothing but right wing hacks that I mentioned earlier. That was actually promoted by the Powell letter. And folks really, really need to look at that Powell letter. I have it inside of that article that I spoke to you guys about on my blog site. The Powell letter is so... I mean, you read the Powell letter, it sounds... it doesn't sound like it's too... It doesn't sound very partisan. It doesn't sound very right-wing or anything like that. But within the essence of that letter, you see the seeds, the building block of indoctrination, controlling the thought process of the American populace. And you can see that from the time all these institutes came out and Reagan came into the picture, that at that point we were no longer worried about reality, truth, numbers, or anything. You ever wondered why it was in these guys' interest to talk about the ivory tower elites?
No.
The reason they talk about these guys is they do what the communists do, and that is you destroy education, you destroy intelligence, you destroy people who think. Because if you do that, then you no longer have people independently looking at what you have to offer and comparing it with what somebody else has to offer. They just tell you, yes, sir.
I was wondering to say something about, like we were talking about Reagan and all this, the time in the era. You may remember back in the day when solar panels were actually put up on the White House during the Carter administration. And, of course, you know, because of big oil, you know, how ugly it was, they started to make out how ugly it was, and there was all this spin, you know, perpetuated from the oil companies, and that, you know, era, that Reagan-Bush one era, you know, came in at that time to make sure that, you know, whatever, for big business, for big oil, that, you know, they were going to crush that these efforts back then, and they did. You know, they made us think differently about how solar panels and how ugly they were on top of roofs, and we got to take them down from the White House, and they took them down, you know. And
can you believe that? You're absolutely correct about that. You're so correct about that. How could they have possibly done that?
Well, yeah,
you know?
I mean, to take down something to where it was beneficial, and then to give it an ugly painting of you know, for really for which it was good, you know, it just showed you back then the agendas that were out back then during the Reagan era, as you were, you know, been talking about part of your show.
Exactly. I mean, the idea was to stupefy everything. When we talk, you know, I don't know if you remember, in the Carter era, they started working on these things called syn fuels. Syn fuels was synthetic fuels. You know, today we have the good name of green energy. I mean, syn fuels wasn't green energy. It was doing things like converting carbon into petroleum, I mean, meaning coal into petroleum and all of that. Not the cleanest of things, but the idea was to start making us self-sufficient. And not only that, but trying to find other industries that would make us green, that would make us be able to put all these things together. And Mike Cisak, I see that apparently there is a problem in bringing up that Social Security thing that I wrote. As we speak, I'm trying to figure out what's wrong with it. But if you go to the main blog page and do more, you can actually get to the article. I'm going to try to fix it in the blog as we speak, however. But, yeah, I'm interested to talk to – hold on a second, John, because – I want to hear from our next radio personality here, Janine, on what she thought about those charlatans that really, what I called, are in the process of destroying the world's economy. That is Rogoff and Reinhardt. Janine?
Well, that's an interesting question, but I do have an opinion about the fact that an outside analysis of the austerity document in question, you know, should just be standard practice. In science, peer review is standard practice. I thought in any academic or scholarly work that this economic thesis was should be subject to peer review and therefore subject to the possibility of contradiction. And I think it was interesting that it took so long and was so shocking that someone who tried to replicate the data could not. But I think that that's become more standard than we'd like to believe. I think that we know there's a lot of junk science out there about climate change. We know there's a lot of junk science out there about other issues that are meaningful to us. Oh, the energy industry is just filled with junk science. Not that all their science is unreplicable, but that a huge amount is. And so I am delighted. When I read this piece, I was delighted to know that someone dared take on this huge assumption. And remember, you were talking about Reagan. And, you know, when Reagan went to supply-side economics, of course, those of us who had studied economics had no idea what he was talking about. But, you know, even his own vice president, George Bush the Elder, called it voodoo economics.
Exactly.
And so we've had this whole notion of voodoo economics for a long time, and so it's created its own body of knowledge, its own posse, so to speak, this whole belief. And what's great about it for some is that it kind of justifies mischief at the mega economic level, at the world view level. And if this mischief is based on false assumptions, if it is, then it's kind of like some kind of justification that we don't have to question what these guys do. They know what they're doing, and it's based on this huge body of knowledge that may be based on a false premise. And certainly those of us that look at the results of economics, you know, the results of what happens when you apply this, I say, pseudoscience, this is my opinion, I'm not speaking for Coffee Party, I'm speaking for myself. I consider this a pseudo-discipline, a pseudoscience, and the outcomes should point to questions. You know, when you have something that you could dare call a jobless recovery, my goodness, what is that? Seriously. We swallowed the notion of a jobless recovery. That's not even possible.
Let her finish, John.
A good stock market. That's to them.
You're correct, John. But I want Janine to finish because what she's saying is so important. Go ahead, Janine, please.
Well, I'm pretty much to the end of it. The one thing I did want to tell you is I did look up Robert Reich's book. It's called Beyond Outrage. Yesterday, his post on his page, robertreich.org, was titled Earth to Washington, Repeal the Sequester.
Wow.
And it's a brilliant piece, and I can put the link in chat, except it's just his name. I'll put it in anyway. And
I appreciate
it's the top blog. Yeah, it's the top blog. But basically, the sequester is a logical extension of austerity.
Absolutely.
And it's a logical extension because, again, it follows false logic. When we look into history, go ahead.
It's worse, and you know, and this is why I'm upset, Janine. It's worse than false logic. You know, false logic is okay. You can have certain false logic, but when you actually cook data the way they did at just the right time to make what politicians wanted to do seem plausible and fact-based, that is a problem. And that has hurt, you know, what people don't get. And this is why I said I really would love for this thing to explode and for people to get a grasp of it. You know, when you talk about Keynesian economics and supply side, sometimes we get into the weeds. How do we make this, and maybe you can help that. How can we make this mean something to the average American person? How can we make, because if I go and start talking about supply side economics, if I go to Starbucks, where I live as my second office, if I go to Starbucks and a kid sits down and I said, you know, Reagan and his supply-side economics has really screwed up the economy because X, Y, Z, I'm going to put him to sleep. But if I look at him
I don't do that. I don't do that, Egberto. What I do is talk about the jobless recovery and what that actually means. What is recovering if it's not jobs? Well, it's wealth.
Exactly.
Wealth is recovering. And to me, one of the biggest scams I've heard in recent times is calling wealth creators job creators, because it's only a coincidental relationship between creating wealth and creating jobs. In the old days, in the times that my mother understands, that was true. You had to make jobs to make products to make wealth, right? But today it's not true. Most money is made with money. When the money works, it doesn't matter if people work. When the money creates profit, it doesn't matter if people do anything. And so if you're wanting an economy, a national economy, that is based on the ability of citizens to thrive, then a jobless recovery is just out of the question. It's out of the question. If nothing else, you don't give people purpose and meaning and inspiration, and you know what I mean? People want to work. And
absolutely.
When anyone calls us a society on the dole or a bunch of slackers, I just want to give them the Three Stooges eye poke, you know, because it's so mean. It is such a mean-spirited concept to say that the majority of Americans don't want to carry their own weight. They do. And I'm personally offended for everybody when anyone says So to me, the real question is, who should drive the economy? And one of the things that came up at the Root Strikers conference I was at last weekend was, should capitalism drive democracy or should democracy drive capitalism?
You know the answer to that, Janine.
I do, but other people have a right to their opinion about that. But I think it's a question worth asking. So don't take it back to Ronald Reagan, who by today's standards would look like a liberal. You know?
No kidding.
So take it back to something right now and today. Opportunism. Opportunism has replaced opportunity. And
absolutely.
Until we change that paradigm, until we as citizens say what kind of economy this republic's democracy should foster, then and take control or take responsibility for that, then we can do something. And the last thing I want to say is, you know, you talk about corporations having personhood, and here's the rub for me. When I owned a business, most people now know that I used to be a business owner, and you know, I had 40 employees.
Well, we get different listeners.
So we
get different listeners. So please, we need you to say that on these different shows over again, because we have a lot of different listeners. Yeah.
Sure. Well, I used to have a business. I'm now retired, and that business was in three states and had 40 employees. And you know, I never paid anyone minimum wage. I gave everyone benefits. It was because when I started, that was the social contract. The social contract was that health insurance and other benefits came through the employer, through the good works of employees. But anyway, I was a corporation, even though the corporation of a tiny number of, there were three people who were holding, it's called a closely held corporation. The corporation's personhood for me was, yes, this entity can have a checking account. Yes, this entity can have an employment number. Yes, this entity can have employees and purchase property and whatever. That was the level of personhood that I experienced. Of course, I was a refugee from multinationals. I had done risk management in two different multinationals and just bailed because it was such a heartless thing going on there. But the point is, personhood is not the same as citizenship. And so you can call corporations people all you want, but that doesn't give them the rights of citizens. And we've blurred that line. There's a lot of people in America who are not citizens. We don't let them vote. We have huge restrictions on what they can do. It's the same thing here. Why should we allow multinational corporations to make political contributions at an unlimited and unrevealed amount levels, you know? They're not citizens. Get the heck out of our elections.
Exactly. So, now, Janine, I have a whole lot of calls. Hold that thought for me because we want to bring that back up, but I'm going to go to 404 and then 620. So 404 is here first. 404, who do I have the honor of being with?
Robert Rodrigo. Hi, Egberto. Hi, Janine.
Roberto Rodrigo. How are you doing, my brother?
I'm marvelous. Nice to hear Janine on Saturday afternoon as well. I don't have enough time usually during the week to catch her, and I like her show, too.
She has a wonderful show.
She does. And like her, you know, you've heard me say before as well, as being a business owner, I don't pay minimum wage either. I refuse to not give people enough money to live on. That is wonderful to hear other people saying the same thing. It's very nice. You know, in addressing what you guys are talking about as far as who's the job creators and stuff, and I think I've said this before on the show, it seems to me that one of the aspects that's going on here on the basis of outsourcing of jobs because of slave labor in other countries, because of the wealth and the inequality and the jobs we're never getting back here in this country, it's almost like the government has been backed into a corner as the only entity that is going to be the large job creator that's left. You know, I've heard a lot of the people on this show and elsewhere in discussions on how, you know, to stop this outsourcing of jobs and stuff. And I don't, in my opinion, if you do not, you can tariff all you want, you can tax all you want, you can punish all you want. Even if you put all of that together, you still have the slave wages on the other end, and they're really, really different. I mean, you can get 100 people for two people's salaries at any level. Those jobs are never coming back, in my opinion. Those 3 million jobs that they gave away from the manufacturing, for example, there's a group of companies that they talk about that I think it's 2.7 million or whatever it is. But it's
right.
A lot more than that because they don't include the banking industry. The banking industry is going nuts with overseas jobs. And I know this from a family member that's actually training people over there that I may have mentioned before. So I look at it when I say, okay, where are we going to get the jobs from? And whatever best case scenario, lower taxes for corporations or raise taxes, I don't care what the scenario is. When you look at it, I still don't see jobs coming from anywhere other than the government.
Robert,
I'm for that.
Let me tell you, I want to stop you there because I want to tell you opposite. I want to concur, first of all, but I also want to say that I am for that. Let me tell you something, okay? First and foremost, the most important thing for having a society is that together we can do better overall than individual, than alone. That's a society. Now, that said, what is extremely important is this. Capitalism is a tool, as I've mentioned before. Now, it is a job of the capitalist framework to prove the need of their existence. And whenever they are no longer able or willing to do what's necessary for that society to remain whole, for that society to remain vibrant, they at that point have no reason to exist or other things must be there to mitigate it. What am I saying? Specifically, what I'm saying is simple. Currently, over the last 30 years, what this system has brought us is a humongous wealth disparity. It is not serving 90% of the population. As such, we the people, the government as well, which is we the people, should do what's necessary to mitigate that. And what is necessary to mitigate that? Is it true that we have fault bridges that are no longer functional or bridges that are underperforming and roads that are underperforming and airports that are underperforming? Is it true that schools are no longer as good as they should be? If all these things are true, then these are things that, going back to what you've said, have the government employ people in these fields until the private system decide that they have competitors. You talk about, oh, those jobs are not coming back because they can work for slave labor. True. But is it also true that the labor portion of every product may be, I don't know what it is, but let's throw a number out there. Let's say 33% of,
sure.
is labor. Then isn't it true that given that the government is not going to be there to make a profit, we'll be taking out that profit because in the case of a government, profit is nothing but a what I like to call a what's that word that you use? When something is not... Anyway, given that it won't need profit, great. Those jobs come right back because it's still effective.
You've actually taken it to another level. You know, one of the places that I go with this, and you are saying it, I just wanted to point it out, is for those who don't like big government, what you're doing is you're trading portions of the government, because if you give people the ability to make a living, I don't care where it comes from, then you eliminate the need for those using the safety net because they can't find work, and you leave the safety net for what its true intentions are, to help
exactly.
people who truly need it. So now you're shrinking government from one direction, which everybody wants. I have no problem with the shrinkage of government. I want government to be more efficient. I just don't want it to leave society behind, like you. So if you shrink the government on one side and remove the people who only use the safety net because they cannot find a living wage or a job, and then you put those people back to work either in the private or in the public sector, because remember, as part of the recession that's been going on, the places that when they talk about, for example, jobs have been, there were $700,000 being lost a month at the end of Bush's presidency, and now they're coming back at, let's just say, an average number of $100,000, whatever it is, 100,000 people, whatever it is.
Right.
Those are every time they say that, they always say private sector jobs, which is important, but the governments are still being forced to shrink because of all those other issues. And people are losing jobs that work for the government left and right, which is they're going into the unemployment ranks, and they have to use the safety net. So
Robert,
if you bring those jobs...
Robert, I want to stop you right there for one reason and come back again. But the reason I wanted to insert that is this. For every government job loss and then a private job that come in, what we have to realize is the wage differential between that government job and that private job that is coming in. Because what happens, what we've noticed that's beginning to happen is the government job is lost with good benefits and good wages, and a private sector job comes with little or no benefits with lower wages. And that differential in the economy is the amount of that differential right there is the amount of money that is transferred then up to the upper classes. Because what we're talking about
absolutely.
Is the owner of these businesses, that delta is the net profit or the net transfer of income and wealth up the ladder. Continue, my friend.
And see, one of the things that they're implementing, and I think we've talked about this briefly before too, overall on the show, is like here I'm in commercial construction. So what I just talked about a job today at my office that they have Davis-Bacon requirements. And for those who don't know, Davis-Bacon requirements are a minimum wage and or benefit per trade in the construction industry that must be met for anybody to contract a job. And then they'll do what's called a certified payroll. So you basically have to swear that you are actually paying the people what you're indicating on your payroll and you meet the contractual obligations. So they're fixing some of that in my industry. And, of course, when Davis-Bacon is used on a job, and this, of course, goes back to me not paying minimum wage, I'm going to bid the job at the level I need to bid it. If I don't get the job at that level, I'm not going lower, so I go on the hole. So, you know, I want to drive prices back up as opposed to where they were when the recession happened and everybody was trying to just work and not pay their bills.
Exactly.
So Davis-Bacon is balancing that out. You always see it on jobs that are on federal establishments, military bases, whatever. But this one job, for example, that I'm bidding week after next is in Atlanta. It is a housing project. It's out in the public, and they're requiring Davis-Bacon. Now, those wages are different wherever they are. They're established usually by the local communities or the states as well as the federal standards, and they're all different. It's a vastly, sometimes I'm paying on a Davis-Bacon job an operator $35 an hour plus fringe benefits, and on another job in another state it's $17 an hour with no benefits. But it's good to have there because it's a lot of people to make a certain wage. People aren't going to get away with, you know, getting around the laws. Everybody has to play on an even playing field, and it drives up the amount of money that people can make making
right.
a fair living. All of these things are very important, and to me, of course, they haven't figured out a way to outsource construction yet. So, you know, in a way, as bad as it was for me in the recession, when business is coming back, it's not bad because I don't have to compete with my jobs going overseas for slave wages. And whatever people might believe when they talk about the immigration issue, I'm telling you right now, even if I had a bunch of illegal guys working for me, they don't work cheap on this area either because I have skilled work that needs to be done.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, so all of that's a myth. At least in commercial concrete. I mean, I've got to hold the building up, so we don't play with trades. We've got to have qualified people.
Otherwise,
so,
you get what happened in Bangladesh, huh?
Exactly. Please. We had a bridge fall here in Atlanta 2 years ago, and I'm like, and I saw who the contractor was, and I said, that's why I don't work for them, because they you know, OSHA. Well, look at the ridiculous thing in West Texas.
In West Texas.
Now, think about that. I actually had forgotten what I saw. I heard it on Mara last night, and I've forgotten an aspect of that. Where ammo nitrate, you have to let Homeland Security know if you have so much
ammonium nitrate.
Ammonium nitrate, yes. I mean, we all know about that in the construction world and in the manufacturing world. Well, they apparently had tons of it, a lot of tons of it.
26,000 gallons, two tanks with 26,000 gallons or something like that each.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, oh, that's great. Oh, that's great. And, of course, his point was that, you know, Texas is the highest where no regulations go on, which isn't very true. But, you know, all of these things matter, and it just seems to me like with what Janine was describing, with the way wealth has been changed, where money's making money now, a very, very good point. And all the issues that you talk about, it just seems to me like we're back into a corner, and there's not that many places you can create jobs anymore. You know, unless something new becomes available, a new technology, or like green, I mean, there are jobs, don't get me wrong. I mean, green energy is doing it and stuff. But there's just, everything else is going. And unless
right.
the world income goes up, unless people are demanding in Africa and Asia, Australia, South America, that they make the same wages as we make here, those jobs are not coming back, and we got to find a place for somewhere else to get them from. That's my issue. So let the government responsibly create infrastructure jobs, technology jobs, R&D jobs, and shrink the people who are using the safety net and unemployment. And, you know, so at least it wouldn't get bigger. It would maybe stay the same size, but it wouldn't get bigger. And so I think that's
Robert,
a responsible way to go at this.
That sounds good. Robert, let me get another caller in. Agree with all that you've said thus far. 620, who do I have the honor of talking with? 620, you're hot.
That's Jack Golden.
Hey, Jack Golden. How you doing, my friend? Talk to me.
Okay. I got issues with the word personhood.
Tell me your issues, Jack.
Okay. We're talking about corporations are people, my friend. That's the Mitt Romney. And also personhood connecting with illegal so-called abortion, the age of the fetus and maybe conception.
Right.
And we're talking about job creators, the Koch brothers. The big danger is with the media. You can't trust the media anymore. Now, Koch brothers.
Wait, hold one second, Jack. Hold a second, because you made an important statement. You said we can't trust the media. I don't know if you were on the beginning of the call. On the beginning of the call, I was talking about this big story with these two economists that really what I call lay the groundwork for the destruction of the world's economy. And the media is not covering this story as it should. Yes, it's all over the internet, but this is a story that should be on day after day after day after day. But anyway, continue, my friend.
Okay, the Koch brothers want to buy up the Tribune, the Chicago Tribune, which is controls the Los Angeles Times and the Baltimore Sun and the at least eight other big newspapers. And this is going to be a real threat because the Koch brothers buy up all these newspapers, all the print media, and we're going to have a dictatorship.
But here's the deal, Jack. They're not after the print media. Here's the funny thing about it, because I was thinking about it, right? I had written a blog about that several weeks ago because they've been planning on buying the Tribune and some other properties, media properties, for some time now. So what I did is I was like, oh, they're buying that. And somebody responded to the blog and saying, but hey, that's newspaper. Nobody reads newspapers anymore. And then I kind of bought that argument till I started to think. Every single newspaper puts their story on the internet now. And I don't know why I was so silly to have not realized that right up front. It does matter. So you are absolutely correct, sir. It matters not because they're buying print newspapers, etc. It matters because all these, all the data that they are going to print in those papers are also on the internet, indexed on the internet, searchable on the internet. Continue, my friend.
Good to see you. Okay. But you got on the internet such crazy things as a Drudge Report and the anything that Fox News prints. Okay, you got to, okay, the Congress also is focusing its efforts on, say, creating, naming new post offices and stuff like that.
Well, actually, Congress.
All right,
another
thing I've heard this morning was airport, the air controllers and that.
Yes.
376 from the House voted for
actually getting rid of the sequester on that. Yes.
This revenue, yeah. Switching
now,
revenue from.
It's amazing that they can find great bipartisan support for issues that affect not most Americans.
Yeah, selfish.
But we have starving kids because of we have 200,000 people in Michigan that's going to be kicked off of unemployment. We have starving kids that are not going to be getting their milk or WIC because there's an across the board cut. Nobody cares about that. But about the airlines running so that the wealthy can fly around the country whenever they want with least of inconvenience, oh, we don't have a problem with that. Now, here's the thing, Jack, and I think it's important. And this is where you come in and all the listeners come in. And it's simply a simple question, and that is, why aren't we pissed? Why aren't we mad? Why aren't we madder? I don't mean mad. I mean, why aren't we climbing up the walls? Why aren't we letting these guys have it? Look how quickly they – look.
Am I still hot?
You are hot, my friend. Talk.
I have to tell you, you got to get me up because yesterday I put on my blog that they are wearing me the F out. You are so right. When we had our last newsroom thing, one of the things that came up is how we – collectively as a group in the Coffee Party missed the 30-minute vote when they decided to repeal the part of transparency in the insider trading stuff, and how we never covered it. We didn't, you know, it wasn't covered by the media and stuff like that. And then the same thing with CISPA. And, you know, so while we were in the middle of the call, Alberto, I happened to discover how well the Library of Congress will keep us informed. So I've been getting everything from them. I'm getting bombarded by them. I got to kind of tone it down a little bit. But yesterday I finally had some time to get into it, and I went through every single thing that the Senate and the House has been doing in the last week, and I was so mad by the time I was done I couldn't read it anymore. There was so much crap and wasting our time. It was amazing, and they had so many unanimous resolutions that had absolutely nothing to do with helping anybody in this world, and you are absolutely right. We should be furious. And again, that was something else that was being talked about last night that reminded me of it. But I had to tell you, I put it in big letters. I said, they are wearing me the F out. I am, every time I turn around, I'm like, you got to be kidding me.
Jack, you wanted to respond?
Okay, am I still on?
Yeah, Jack, you're on.
Okay. Dedication of new post offices and other buildings and other stuff like that. I mean, it's a waste of time. I don't know. It should take a million-man march on Washington to get those light a fire under their behinds to do something. I just have no respect for either party. I think the Democrats are almost as equal to blame as the Republicans.
Okay, I have a goal for you. Jack, and everybody on this call right now, I have a question to each one of you. Have you, first of all, and this is, I don't remember who gave me, I think it was Joe Pomponio that told me this, and I followed Joe Pomponio's lead. Joe Pomponio once, on one of the calls, he said, Egberto, you should have all your immediate politicians on speed dial. And you know what I did? I placed them on speed dial because as political aware, as activist as I am and doing all these things on the outside out there, being around the people and we're doing things together, believe it or not, I didn't have all these guys on speed dial, so I did that. And you know what I do now? when things like this happen, you call them up. You register that vote. Hey, how did you guys do that? My question to you all, and by the way, let me bring you back in, John, from Joy Z. Did you call the politicians this week, John?
Did I call any politicians this week? No.
Yes? Okay, no. Please do. Next week is coming, Monday. Well, I think they're off this week, but next week. Everybody that's hearing this should call the politicians immediately. Send an according to Janine, I see. Come on, Janine, you're hot. Why don't you tell them what to do? Janine, you're hot.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry. I had muted myself because my dog was barking. And you missed my joke about me being hot, so that's probably a good thing.
You are hot too, Janine. We know that.
Okay. So listen, when I was in Washington, D.C. for the Coffee Party Lobby Day just after the Enough is Enough rally, the citizen intervention, I went to each of my rep and my two senators, and there was a guy answering the phone. And all he did was answer the phone. I believe he was an intern. But I tell you what, they love that job. They want to talk to you. They keep statistics. They write down what you say. And they take pride in the quality of that report. And when I asked a couple of them, is this kind of busy work or whatever, and he said, oh, no, this is the best job in the office. I get to talk to the constituents. I get to find out what they know. And the senator looks at this report every morning. And so I felt hugely, I'd sort of been hesitant to call before. I sort of thought, oh, you know, it's some grumpy, I guess I figured, you know, Lily Tolman and the one ringy dingy, you know. But no, they want to know, and the phone is an excellent way. But I posted in chat that I have them in my contact list. That's on my computer, same contact list is on my phone. So I can call them, I can email them, I can fax them, and I can send them a postcard because I have their addresses for their Oregon places and their national address.
That is so important, and you know, I mean, it is so important. Now, I want to clarify something, and then let me bring 707 in first. 707, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
It's me again. Same thing.
Oh, you must have fell off, Linda. That's fine. I got you back. Did you speak to any of your politicians this week, Linda?
Oh, God, yeah.
Good.
I got a speed dog. It's like Janine. I got them in my email and everywhere else.
Excellent.
I'm on their newsletters. I called West Chesboro about a moratorium on fracking, which would be the first in the country that would actually put a legal framework so that we can actually do real science to find out what's happening with the chemicals.
Yep. Okay.
Go ahead. Well, I called Barbara Boxer and Senator Feinstein. So I did do it. Yeah.
Excellent.
I forgot what you were talking about. I'm sorry, bro. Just go
That's
ahead.
All right.
What were you gonna say?
That's okay. I need to make a comment to somebody in the chat room. CSAC. I guess he's still CSAC may still be pushing the or believing that somehow austerity works, and CSAC says specifically. Let me go to the thing because misinformation is something that we've got to clean up and not allow to metastasize in people's brains, because that is how, you know, misinformation out there actually causes harm. And I mean serious harm, because people tend to believe in the plausibility of stupidity. And that is something we have to get around. He says,
and if the last 2 weeks did not prove that, then it will never be noticed.
Exactly.
Because the how ridiculous it was in the last 2 weeks was so obvious. I was talking to Michael earlier this week, and one of the things that struck me just real quick on the misinformation with the Boston situation was, you know, he had made a comment properly that they had immediately started with the conspiracy theory, and my problem with it was, because I had a discussion, long discussion with somebody that I know a long time about it, when it in real time.
there was no way that there was enough time to create an evidentiary basis for any other theory than what you were seeing before your eyes.
Right.
It was too quick. It was instantaneous where all the false flag thing came out and all this other crap. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding. You can't. And then not only that, on top of it, you've got Steve Emerson, the self-proclaimed terrorist expert, running his mouth on Hannity, and they ran for it. And all of the media on that side of the coin decided to talk about it. I did a 12-hour watch of how that story grew in real time. It was amazing to me. And then the next day, how everybody started backtracking, and of course it was shown not to be true. And in the meantime, we've got senators and congressmen actually talking about it in the hearing with our Homeland Security chairman, whatever the person is. And I'm like, oh my God. So what I did is I went into the Library of Congress again, that wonderful thing, and I went and pulled the film for the whole hearing, and I posted it. I said, now, watch the hearing and tell me if this is not absurd. And just leave it at that, because if there is not a more perfect example of what you're talking about, misinformation, in the last 2 weeks, there never will be.
That is crazy, but, you know, you're so right about how the misinformation work, but this one hits me to the core. Mike Cisak says, I'm curious. If austerity cut in government spending, come on, Mike, we all know austerity means cut in government spending, causes an economic slowdown, why then did we have economic booms after massive cuts after World War I and World War II? That is such a, Mike, you come with us all the time and you're here all the time, but that statement on its own, just from the practical point of view, how could you possibly say that? After World War I and World War II, what was it that we had to do? Rebuild massively. How dare you call that a cut? It was a cut in defense. It was not a cut in the economy at large. Lest we forget, after World War II, we had the GI Bill. We had all these different policies, progressive policies, that rewarded those brave people that fought these wars for a change in this country. We rewarded those people that really, if you want to put it bluntly, kept us free. For a change. We didn't do what we did to them after Vietnam. We didn't do what we did to them after the first Gulf War. We didn't do what we did to them, what we're doing to them now, which is using austerity even on the soldiers we claim we love. The soldiers we claim we owe something to. Look, folks, austerity. And anyone claiming austerity is succumbing to evil. You are succumbing to evil if, after all that is out there, all the evidence, all the people that have died, all the people that have lost their wealth, all the people that have suffered, if you are trying to tailor an argument to justify a policy simply not to be wrong, then you have also adopted a policy that lends it to call yourself evil. And I'm biting no words there, people. This is real. People are hurt by these policies. Your own families are hurt by these policies. So I do not want to hear people, after hearing the evidence, it is okay not to know something. It is okay to be ignorant. That is fine. What is not okay is after you're presented with irrefutable facts, to then continue to try to fit your image of reality that has hurt people. We can't keep going down that road. That is what's destroying and tearing this country apart, folks.
Egberto.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I wanted to say something about, okay, if, you know, the great 50s, you know, and we had Republican Eisenhower and, you know, your friend there who's speaking on the phone about construction and all that. Okay, we spent massive amounts of money on government. We had, yes, we had high taxes, but we had the according to what most people think of the modern day era, that the Eisenhower era was the best era in America, according to everybody, and it was high taxes and it was low unemployment, and accordingly that was the best era. And how come we can't, like, hey America, this was the best era, and that was the era of high spending and low unemployment, and that you shove it back in their face, that this is the era that you guys and most Americans call the greatest era.
You know, it's you know, sometimes John, what you say is important. What you just said is important. Okay, very, very important, because people forget that. People forget that during the time of our largest economic growth, what things like taxes were. We somehow like to tie taxes to growth. We love to look at something called the Laffer curve. Folks, look up the Laffer curve, another creation of the Powell manifesto. Yes, it wasn't during the Powell times, but what I'm saying, if you look at the flavor of what Powell was trying to do, it is based. These types of theorists came out of having to prove that capitalism in the form that we practice it is absolute and not capitalism used as a tool. I think there's a Skype caller here, but just listening. If you want to talk, please press 1. I won't call you unless you press 1 and let me know you want to talk. I want to see if Janine has anything to add here. Janine, I was just telling you. Whoa.
I do have something to say about this. Am I too loud? You just went, oh.
Yeah, actually, you scream a bit. But before you come in, Janine, I want to say one thing to my friend C-Sec thing, because we stand here on being able to have a civil discourse, and not only that, not name call or whatever. I tried every time I said evil, and I'll go back and review what I've said, that the process of what's being done is evil. And I also needed to state specifically that if after knowing the reality and looking at the truth, and you continue to do things that which will hurt another human being, that by definition is evil, and it's not a name call. It is a description of an action. Thank you, Janine. You're on.
Oh, sure. So there's another piece to this Eisenhower era that sometimes I think so many years down the road we forget, and that is that America learned the value of social investment. In other words, after World War I, the world was angry at Germany. They didn't care if everybody starved to death. As far as they're concerned, Germany could just go cease to exist. And so Germany was left to its own means to save itself from annihilation, basically. They were starving to death. Their money meant nothing. You know, it was a terrible time, and it fostered the possibility of someone like Hitler. And so what we learned from World War I, we executed in World War II, which was after that war was over. We rebuilt Germany. We rebuilt Japan. We saw the value of social investment as a means to, by bringing everyone back into the civilized world.
Right.
And putting a period at the end of that sentence. And so I think it's important to realize that if you substitute the unemployed, if you substitute the disenfranchised in this country with that philosophy, the whole social investment philosophy, you can see that the austerity, sequester, all these gimmicks, they're not proven.
Right.
That these gimmicks are really leading us to that kind of discounting the enemy.
Thank you, Jenny.
Back then it was Germany. Today it's the unemployed. It's the immigrant. It's the... the union worker. It's just find a million ways to segregate us into out groups.
That
and then
is prevent.
So there is no social value to inclusion. And we know that's not true. I mean, we've learned that in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of history.
Janine,
go ahead.
You hit it on the money. It is so important.
That's a marvelous point.
You hit it on the money.
the Marshall Plan, that hits it on the head.
Exactly.
Even on
totally.
The relationship to today.
Absolutely.
Totally.
Janine, let me bring in 661 and then I bring you back in. But that, Janine, was a point that I hope everybody here listened to, because, you know, for those people who are just pushing these things that actually materially hurts the middle class, people that can't afford to be hurt right now, when all we did was transfer to the top, it's ridiculous. 661, you're hot. Who am I speaking to?
I'm Paul.
Hey, Paul, how you doing? Talk to me, my friend.
Well, I just tuned in, so I'm not really sure what the topic is. It sounds like it may be spending, is it?
Well, actually, we were the whole issue. We were supposed to cover three topics today, but we actually stayed on one that I really am glad that we stayed on, because it's not really being covered by the media as it should, and it's basically the fraud that was effected on the entire world economy by Rokoff and Reinhardt, two economists who had claimed that debt at a 90% of GDP is a tipping point, and it was proven by a 28-year-old grad student that there was no correlation between debt and tipping point into recessive growth. So that it's a very important paper that was debunked, not by 100 years of economic policy, but 800 years of economic research. But go ahead, Paul.
Well, I don't really like to make things complicated. So I have a fairly simple idea as to the whole, economics, making it stable, and just in general, the financial state. I have a very simple approach to it, which is in opposition to a lot of people think. My approach is pretty much institute the Fair Tax Act, limit government, and reduce foreign aid. And
wow. Let me ask you this. Now here you're correct about making things simple. Now I have one important thing, okay?
Okay.
I said on our program, we make sure to be fact based. Mathematical model, if it's not in reality, do you have to prove that instituting those things with a complex economy will actually work? Because it is easy to say, I want to balance a budget, I want to do X, Y, Z. My question is, do you understand the implications of doing everything that you claim? Let me give a good example to what you said. You said you want to limit foreign aid, right? If limiting foreign aid to certain countries mean that certain countries then get destabilized in such a manner that it affects the natural resources that we import into this country, reducing that foreign aid could actually end up costing America more money than it saves. So I'm saying, whenever we talk about policy, it is very important that we look at causation, cause and effects, because sometimes saving money in one place, as Krugman has shown mathematically, that is, that reduce that by austerity actually costs more in lost taxes than actually spending more where you increase certain things. So I mean, I whenever somebody say, oh, I want to make it simple, we just do X, Y, Z. I said, simple would work if you have a simple economy. If you don't have a simple economy, you have an interrelation of many things occurring. There's nothing simple about it, and you may want it simple, but it just cannot be simple because it's not. Do you follow what I'm saying, Paul?
I get what you're saying, and that's pretty much that's what I hear from a lot of people. The problem is that people have made it complicated over time, and I'm not saying I'm not saying that my solution is something that can be done overnight. It has to be a gradual process. We have to make the whole foreign aid deal. I know that's not an overnight process, but it can be very simple. People make things complicated, put red tape in the way, do this, do that. So, it's on the back burner, eventually that. But, so many people like to say it is so complicated. And, people have made it complicated, and in some ways it is complicated. But if you simply just, lay everything on the table and just make a plan, you can do it. And all I've seen happening lately is just making things even more complicated. And
I'm going to agree with you in one place, Paul.
People call that progress.
I want to agree with you with certain things, right? Let's look at our tax system, right? There are a lot of cutaways and breakouts and things that make things unnecessarily complicated. And going back onto what I said with, do you have research proof XYZ? There are certain things that don't require research, right? In other words, if somebody just came up on research and say, I need a tax break for XYZ, then there's no, and there's no research as to why that is going to be good for the economy, yeah, that's an unnecessary complication. And we can go through a whole lot of that makes your state, that parts of your statement true. What the parts of your statement, however, that I don't like is the assumption that just saying something is simple, make it so. That's not the case.
I didn't say that it would be overnight. I said that it can be made simple.
And I buy that with you, sir. Paul, I really understood what you said, and I am agreeing partially with you, but what I want to tell you or what I want to suggest to you is that there will be items within budgets, within economies, that are necessarily complicated. I mean, just the existence of Paul is necessarily complicated. You're a very complex being.
So, I know that.
Roberto,
yeah,
can I say one thing?
Hold on. Let Paul finish, John. Let Paul finish. Go ahead, Paul.
You know, I've talked to, you know, various people that are considered pretty high in education, you know, PhDs, engineers, and I ask them very simple questions, and they say, well, I could fill a chalkboard with that. And say, you know, all you need to do is just look at it simplified. Just use a little common sense. A little common sense goes a long way. People have made things complicated, and nobody gets that.
Okay, look, Paul, there are a lot of truths to what you say with things being complicated unnecessarily, and I think you would agree with me as well that there are, in fact, however, things that we cannot remove the complications.
I don't agree with that. We can remove complications.
We have to want to.
Okay, Paul. I appreciate it. Hey, look, Paul, keep on calling, buddy. Go to John. Go ahead, John.
Well, I'd like Paul to be there. Can I ask him what he knows and understand what a progressive tax system is?
You know,
you can answer, Paul.
I'm not familiar with the whole progressive tax system. Is I don't really know a whole lot
you,
of.
But you,
you
just
know,
want
term.
It simple. You just want it simple.
I want it simple.
For what reason?
For what reason?
Is it too
because
complicated?
Because the more you complicate things, the more it gets hard to work with, the more excuses people can make. If you have a simplified tax system, it makes it easier to work with.
Yeah, but if certain people make more money and certain people make less money, and if you have it too simple, then it actually defavors the people who make less money.
How?
You don't understand? Sure it does, because if you have a progressive tax system, you have it to where the disposable income for those who have less then in essence has more, and because they need more in order to spend and be helpful and the productive for society, okay, you're asking for something which is actually counter to the goodness of the middle class having additional money in their pocket.
Yeah, that's a very important point, Paul, that John is making there. But I have, given that we're running out of time and I have a new caller, I want to get to that. But, you know, this is a subject we're going to be covering.
I just want to say one more thing.
Okay, real quick, please, Paul.
What you're referring to, what I want to do is make everybody pay taxes based on their consumption. If you use a progressive tax system, you're basically penalizing people for having a lot of money.
Okay, that's not true, but I'll address that other time. But look here, next, we have a lot to talk about where it comes to income disparity and the causation of income disparity. Because when you just said, Paul, that you're penalizing people for having income, that is assuming that the income that they had was really warranted, or that they somehow, you know. And I can go into a whole lot of subjects about that I don't want to hit right now because of time constraints, but keep calling because
the Eisenhower time frame was the most progressive tax system, and that's the era that we called the best era.
Okay, now, okay, John, I'm going to hold you off right there. Let's go to 816. 816, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
This is Jay Egberto.
Jay Tice, Dr. Tice. Folks, now, this man is very knowledgeable on not only on the politics, but on the financial issues that are happening throughout the years. Talk to me, Dr. Tice.
Well, anytime I hear somebody talk about simplifying the tax code, I have to wonder what kind of income bracket they're in, because my taxes were very simple. It didn't take me 30 minutes to do my taxes this year. How much more simple can we make it? Typically, when people say simplify the only people that have a tough time doing taxes are wealthy people that are trying to evade their taxes. 90% of Americans spend less than an hour doing their taxes.
Very good point. Very good point.
So I don't know how much simpler we can make it, unless you're trying to make it simpler for Mitt Romney to not pay taxes.
Right. Well, you see, you know, Paul, I'm sorry that I'm not giving you a chance to respond at this time, but next week we'll cover income disparity as well. But here's the thing that I talk about, Dr. Tice, and that really gets to me, and it goes this way. You're a professor at a college.
Right.
It is your job to ensure that knowledge moves forward to the next generation. You are integral, and I continuously say this, and it's important that it is said. It is the responsibility of the teaching profession to keep society moving forward. Yet, the stockbroker who produces nothing. And to everyone listening, I want you to get that right. The stockbroker produces nothing. He does nothing to move society forward educationally. He does nothing. He creates nothing. He invents nothing. He produces no service other than to move monies around. Yet, he makes orders of magnitude more so than teachers, than Dr. Tice. How is that not taxing his income for that aberration within our capitalist structure? How is that not the right thing to do, Doctor?
How is that not the right thing to do? It's not the wrong thing to do. We should be doing that.
Thank you.
We should be taxing people. And even Adam Smith, the founder of capitalism, thought of as the father of capitalism, wrote that it is the luxuries of life that ought to be taxed, and that the people who consume their income buying necessities should not pay tax. It's the people spending their money on the luxuries that should be paying all the taxes. Thomas Jefferson talked about that in a letter to James Madison. So this is a sort of perversion of capitalism by basically the Randians that keep saying that if you have lots of money, it's because you earned it. I don't know. I don't think Sam Walton's heirs earned anything. They happened to win the genetic lottery.
Thank you. It is that is amazing. And, you know, whenever people tell me that, you know, we can't tax the rich enough or whatever, I always like to refer them to one thing we all learned in school from all you great teachers. You know what I mean? From all the teachers that are keeping us moving forward, simple arithmetic.
Right.
And that goes this way. How can you possibly say that knowing math if 90% of all wealth belongs to 10% of the people? If 60% of all income belong to 20% of the people? How can you mathematically tell me that the rich cannot be taxed enough to cover what they've pilfered from the middle class?
Well, I agree. And in fact, for 30 years, the wealthy have been telling us you can't tax us because we create the jobs. And just look around. How great has that worked out for us?
Thank you. Evidence. Evidence is what's important here, and that's what I was talking to a caller within the, a person within our chat room. I was specifically telling him, look, it's not like we don't have evidence for this stuff. It's not like we don't have math. It's not like we don't have the numbers. You have to finagle, you have to twist yourself in knots not to see the truth here. You have to twist yourself in knots.
You have to remember, Egberto, that part of the polarization of this discussion is, for example, when you talk about addressing teachers, for example, when it comes from certain directions in our society that teaching is basically Marxist, socialist, all across the board. I've had discussions during the election cycle more than ever, you know, on how leftists are entire university staff is, for example, throughout the country. You know, not that everybody's teaching the same way. It was an amazing discussion. Or how little people do look at the math. For real, you know, again, everybody's relying on the opinions of those others that instead of, because, of course, the media, for the most part, is only doing opinions, instead of actually looking and pulling the covers and looking at it for themselves.
Robert,
so that's as much as anything going on here.
Yeah, time is going fast now, I'm going to have to shut down the show because we're about to get, but I want to say something. I was writing a paper earlier this week. And I'd called Dr. Seitz because I couldn't remember the Powell manifesto. What the name? I couldn't remember the name Powell. And I just sent him an email. I called him real quick. I wanted to get that information. But I will urge everybody listening to this, both live and on the podcast, to go read the Powell letter. Robert just said something important about universities and why the attack on teachers. Why? Notice that the right wing attack teachers. They are constantly trying to attack them. They attack universities. They attack all these things. It is because these are places that simply are fact-based, working on truth. They try to infiltrate these areas to try to push pseudo-truths out there. That is a job of the right at this point, putting out pseudo-truths. The reason they attack on teachers, the reason they attack on all these issues is to try to decrease the knowledge of the average American citizen, not the knowledge of all. But the knowledge of the average American citizen, so that they don't really understand that they're actually being pilfered. But with that, we got to close out the show. And I want to ask, and this time I'm holding you to 10 seconds. Robert, give me a 10-second closeout.
10-second closeout. I gave somebody the Lewis Manifesto. I posted online about once every 2 months, and they actually thought I was showing them something that was written just yesterday. They thought it fit societally nice.
Thank you very
again.
Much.
Thank
You're
you
done. Thank you, Robert. Call next week, my brothers. Jack, 10 seconds.
Me?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, well, I would just say...
Oh, no, hold on. That's okay. Jack Golden.
I have to agree, agree with Paul. Keep it simple, stupid.
Okay, Jack.
And
thank you very much, my friend.
Our issue is absolutism versus relativism.
Thank you, Jack. John, you're on.
Is absolutist.
Yeah, I think it's like you say in regards to schooling. It's instead of free thinking, you know, they want indoctrination thinking.
Thank you very much, John. Linda, you're on. 10 seconds.
Just please put those links, like the Powell letter, onto your blog also, because the chat doesn't work for my phone.
Thank you very much, Linda, and thank you for calling, guys. I hope you call next week. Paul, 10 seconds.
Going by what I said, it seems like it's pretty much just. The left throwing stones at the right throwing stones at the left, and just never ends.
No, we don't want to do that, Paul, and that's why if you notice
that's
you come here and you get to say your piece, and we'll make sure that continues. So keep calling, my friend. Jay, you're closing us out. Jay?
Well, I would just say people need to look around and think about why government is doing the things it is doing today. It didn't just come out of a vacuum. In a democracy, the people demanded government do certain things to stop oppression, to stop exploitation. That's why government is doing much of it. And if we quit having government do it, the same forms of oppression and exploitation will come back.
Thank you, Doc. Thank you, Doc. And my dear Janine.
Well, I guess my final words are America rocks. And staying engaged nurtures this republic's democracy.
Thank you very much, Janine. That was very important. Folks, please remember I'm going to be quick here. On Mondays at 10 p.m., Press 1 for Democracy with Dan Aronson. On Tuesdays at 8 p.m., The Middle Ground with Michael Cherney and Eric Beiler. On Thursday, we have Lunch with Loudon. That's the person just spoke at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. On Saturdays, of course, you're with me, Politics Done Right. thank you very much for spending some time with me. Come back next week. We discuss real fact-based issues, whether you're in the right, left, middle. I don't care where you're from. Let's talk. If you're really interested in this country, if you're really interested in moving forward, we will be hearing for you, and we will be having a discussion, forceful but civil. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful Saturday.